When I started out as a university lecturer, I was given a piece of advice by one of the older owners of staff. He said, lectures are very difficult things. Students tend to go to sleep. They're very dull. What you must do is you must tactically disrobe as the lecture is going on. So you start beginning, after 5 minutes, take off your jacket, then maybe take off your sweater, start unbuttoning your shirt. This will keep them interested. They'll want to see how far you go. So you reach the halfway point, then you start putting all the clothes back on again. And I mention that because I am quite hot. I was at the station today, and they forced me to jog up here, and I'm a bit sweaty. So I might actually keep my jacket on, making it a little sweltering. Thank you. I'm going to talk for a little bit about Tolkien and women. And I'm going to try, if I get time, if I don't bloviate beyond my allotted space, to expand what I'm going to say, to address fantasy more generally. Fantasy is a huge field. It's really the main area of fantastica, commercial fantasy. Fantasy novelists tend to sell much more than poor little science fiction novelists like me. And I'm going to start with Tolkien because it seems such an unpromising combination, really. There he is, looking very handsome on the left with his moustache. Surprisingly, full head of hair, I think, on the right, given his advanced age. Not that I'm jealous. So there'll be two parts of what I say. I'm going to start off by just talking about women in Tolkien. That is a harder task than the second part, which is to talk about the female and the male logics of fantasy and science fiction, more generally speaking. I'm going to try and segue from one into the other. So the obvious, the opening gambit, I suppose, would be to point out how few women there are in Tolkien, how relatively rarely Tolkien writes a female character. I'm not here to attack Tolkien. I'm not going to put him in the dock as an old school sexist or a reactionary or a conservative. I think he was a conservative and I'm not. He was certainly a Catholic and I'm not, and I'm prepared to respect his views. I think they inform what he writes without agreeing with them, or I think collaborating with them, but nonetheless I think there is something more interesting going on in Tolkien's representation of gender, of women, than merely something to be denigrated, something to be attacked. That said, there are no women at all in The Hobbit. The recent blockbuster movies, slightly incoherent, visually spectacular blockbuster movies, have had to shoehorn in a female elf, because even Hollywood, which is hardly a bastion of progressive sexual politics, has looked at this book and thought, well, you know, it's all boys. So they've brought in Evangeline Lilly from Lost, who's playing a character, I think, called Pouty the Elf. She's very comely and she's very nifty with a bow and arrow. There are, I'm going to argue, three women in The Lord of the Rings. And I'm going to talk through those three in a minute. So The Lord of the Rings has a slightly better hit rate than The Hobbit, but even so, when Peter Jackson made the original trilogy of Lord of the Rings films, he felt he had to beef up the female contingent. He had to give more screen time to Arwen and to make more of a character out of the female individuals. This is slightly more complicated than it might otherwise be. We don't want to simply tick off male and female characters as if they fall neatly into a grid. Part of the force of these books, both of these books, is that they are about the entry of a feminised individual, a hobbit, a domestic, a bourgeois, a soft individual. This is how Thorin described him in one of the unfinished tale versions of the Hobbit story. He is soft, soft as the mud of the Shire, when he's talking to Gandalf, and Gandalf agrees, he is soft. He's sort of girly, but he has to go out into this big manly world and do all these manly things with swords and kill dragons and destroy rings and all those other sorts of things. Oh yeah, I've even got a picture of Pouty the Elf, looking very, very nice. So there are three female characters, really, in Lord of the Rings. There are lots of minor characters that we could pick out if we want to be particular about it. But really there are three. There's Shelob, there is Eowyn, and then there is Galadriel. They have, as it were, page time. They're on the page. Otherwise, all the protagonists, the whole of the Fellowship of the Ring, the wizards, the antagonists, all the orcs, all the elves, all the men, Boromir and Faramir, they're all not just men, but manly men. And the trajectory, the path that these feminized domestic hobbits must take is to enter into this manly world and become more manly. And this is part of a kind of Inkling's logic. This is from Elaine Good's essay, Angels in the Inkling House, which was published in Science Fiction Studies. And she's quoting C.S. Lewis, Tolkien's friend, his statement to Bede Griffiths that, quote, "the decay of friendship owing to the endless presence of women everywhere is a thing I'm rather afraid of." Now, according to Good, this best exemplifies the fundamental feeling of the Inklings, that the bonds between men are weakened by the presence of women. Now, Tolkien's a writer, we all know, whose own masculinity was forged in a particularly heated crucible in the First World War, when he went off and forged friendships with men in an environment where life and death was at stake every day. He comes home. This is not a prejudice invented by Tolkien and his friends. In this sense, he's of his time, of his caste. The association of men on the one hand with strength and women with weakness is woven deeply into the fabric of what we may as well call, although... saucy. Let's see how far I go. When the shoes come off, then you have to worry. But the door, the exits are over there if you start getting too alarmed. I don't want to make a meal of this negative critique of Tolkien's women. Speaking personally, and any critique that engages with questions of feminism must acknowledge one of the key insights of 60s and 70s feminist thinkers, that the personal cannot be magically separated out from the political. Speaking personally, I do not share what I take to be Tolkien's beliefs or assumptions about women, or about many other things, for that matter. This isn't so much to say, really. Those beliefs and assumptions are much less widely held in the 21st century than they were at the beginning of the 20th. By the same token, I think judging Tolkien by a set of ideological criteria he himself would not have recognised runs the risk at least of anachronism, and can, I think, be actively distorting. So what I want to try and do over the next half hour or so is develop an argument that says something more interesting than mere reactionary sexism is at work in Tolkien's writing about women, not despite, but because of the immanent conservative Catholic religious cast of his writing. The intention is to do more than just work through the various female characters in his books. The argument, I think, goes to the heart of everything that Tolkien was writing about. And because he's been as influential as he has on the subsequent developments of fantasy, it's an argument then about fantasy as a genre, or as a mode, perhaps I should say. I'm not trying to argue that Tolkien's representations of women can be, as it were, redeemed for modern readers from within the ideological assumptions of modern conservatism. Although, of course, there are conservative critics who think that just that. The American politician Christine O'Donnell, for instance, has written several times that she praises Tolkien's representation of women. She thinks that Tolkien celebrates women as women rather than judging them as men. It is not an argument that persuades me. Tolkien was drawn to a particular portrayal of elvish women, like Galadriel or Arwen or Luthien. The latter, Luthien, became one of the ways in which he kind of imaginally conceptualised his own wife. The argument goes he was drawn to that as an ideal because he had a higher regard for women than for men, because he saw them as existing on a better or purer or more spiritual plane than men. This seems to me a non-starter. A rather clunky iteration of the feminine mystique, so brilliantly poignarded by Betty Friedan's celebrated 1960s polemic. So where does this leave us? It's a topic on which I think even the best critics can become defensive. No fiction, says Charles Moseley in his study of Tolkien, can satisfy every orthodoxy or all of those that are differently conditioned from those of its own time. And Moseley wants to say, well, there's more to Tolkien's women than simply this rather restrictive conservative idealization, putting on a pedestal of characters like Lúthien and Galadriel. Tolkien gives us glimpses, he thinks, of other possibilities. The Silmarillion tells of the heroic Haleth, first chief of the Haladrin, leading her people on the terrible journey through Nan Dungaltheb. Nan Dungaltheb. That was my old Nan's name, Nan Dungaltheb. Sometimes you have to wonder. He has such a fine ear for the cadence of language, for the etymology of English, and for the way words can work. It's all the more alarming when it lets him down. I'm sure people in this room know that originally Frodo was going to be called Bingo Baggins. It's a terrible name. People had to come to Tolkien and say, no, don't call him Bingo, that's no good. Anyway, let's put Nan on one side. The Storrs, Gollum's people, seem to have been matriarchal. In the Silmarillion, it is Melian, wife of Thingol, whose power and wisdom guarded the realm of Doriath in Lord of the Rings. Galadriel is the only figure able to resist all the enemies, save Sauron himself. In Rohan, we meet Eowyn, a moving cameo of a woman who knows she is trapped. For her, though a shield maiden, the practice of heroism, the ultimate values of her society, it is impossible unless she discards her identity and becomes Durnhelm, which of course is what happens in the story. There is, I think, some pathos in the way that Eowyn is forced to discard her identity in order to escape the confinements of her gender in that novel. But we can't, I think, ignore the fact that all the other women mentioned here come with identities, as it were, conveniently pre-discarded. Moseley's critique of Tolkien is, in other respects, I think, sensitive and intelligent, but where gender is concerned, it feels like special pleading. He likes Tolkien. He doesn't want to have to slag Tolkien off for the way that Tolkien does women. It can be argued, he says, that Tolkien is interested less in the specific social than in the generic human, as if that latter can somehow be magically separated out from the former, which I don't think it can. A crucial aspect of his larger existential drama, the one he's writing about in The Lord of the Rings, is about the choices we make, the choices we are given, and how we encounter these troubles and this change, whether specifically we encounter it actively or passively. And the problem, it seems to me, with eliding the female experience into a generalised masculine one is that it ignores the extent to which passivity is forced upon women as the only socially acceptable way of behaving. So this question of enforced passivity, which is absolutely central to many discourses of feminism, the social critiques of feminism, is present, I think, in all three of the main characters. Let's start with Shelob. Shelob functions as a kind of grotesque caricature of enforced passivity, a beast of prey who does not go out to hunt like wolves or bears, but rather hides in darkness waiting for her prey to come to her. Lurking in her den is how Tolkien puts it. She is all appetite, drinking the blood of elves and men, bloated and grown fat with endless brooding on her feasts. Her sexual desires are one with her eating and drinking, knowing that readers will connect her existence with the big spiders in Mirkwood, in The Hobbit, that Bilbo had already encountered. Tolkien says, all living things were her food, and her vomit, darkness. Far and wide her lesser broods, bastards of the miserable mates of her own offspring that she slew, spread from glen to glen. From the FL Duath to the Eastern Hills to Dial Guldur and the fastnesses of Mirkwood, but none could rival her, Shelob the Great. She's a proper monster. She's a good monster. She's a scary monster, but she's a very female monster in a bad way, I think. In part, I think this owes something to Milton. You'll know the end of, I think it's book two in Paradise Lost, where Satan encounters death and sin. And sin is his daughter, and death is his son that he's fathered on sin. This is William Blake's illustration of that scene. And sin is this sort of arachnoid force that squats in the darkness. So in part, I think Tolkien is drawing on that. But it also invokes a common enough kind of black widow phobia that some men share, a male fearful desire for the feminine principle. So it also reduplicates precisely the claustrophobic passivity of Shelob's evil. She breeds with herself. She eats her own mates, who are also her own offspring. She has no care for the outside world, little she knew of or cared for towers or rings or anything desired by mind or hand. For herself, a glut of life alone, swollen toll upon the mountains, that may be a typo, could no longer hold her up, and the darkness could not contain her. This monstrous passivity, in other words, is death. It's the solipsistic death that swallows up all life. And it's this, I think, rather than the sometimes quite clumsy descriptions of the hideous physicality of Shelob, which are also thoroughly feminized, that underpin her monstrosity. In the latter case, we get this description. Behind her short, stalk-like neck was a huge swollen body, a vast bloated bag swaying and sagging between her legs. The belly underneath was pale and luminous and gave forth a stench. So it speaks to the novel's larger sense of the female. I could appropriate Robert Graves's laconically sexist phrase. Graves said, "Woman is, man does." And this is a sort of parodic version of that. This is pure isness in this horrible, passive, brooding, devouring, killing, death-like force. It's picked up by the fan art if you talk about. There's a rather nice that's a proper art. Here's some fan art. There's Shelob on the left. I mean, I'm a happily married man, I must say, but there's something quite appealing about that. I have to go on the right there, this weird, the Sphinx-like caricature that's going on. Let's talk about Eowyn. Eowyn is sharply distinguished from this parodic, fleshly femaleness. There's no sagging, swaying female curves on her, and certainly no stench emanating from her euphemistically named between legs lower belly, like in Shelob. On the contrary, Eowyn is tall and straight and as strong as a sword, as strong, in fact, as a boy. She is also chilly chaste. She is not a sexual being, where Shelob is all darkly repulsive sexual fecundity. Very fair was her face, Tolkien tells us. Her long hair was like a river of gold. Slender and tall she was in her white robe, girt with silver. But strong she seemed, and stern as steel, a daughter of kings. Thus Aragorn, for the first time in the full light of day, beheld Eowyn, lady of Rohan, and thought her fair, fair and cold, like a morning of pale spring that has not yet come to womanhood. Gold and silver may be semantically connected with beautiful women in terms of preciousness, but where the passage moves to steel, we understand that the gold and silver here are more invoked for their metallic qualities. Eowyn is metallic in the sense of being hard, and she is repeatedly linked with metal weapons. The sword was set upright before her, hands were upon the hilt. Eowyn saw the glitter of their spears as she stood still. She was clad to the waist like a warrior and girded with a sword. Whenever she's introduced into the novel, this is stressed. Her clear voice was like a ring of steel, says Tolkien, at the Battle of Pelennor Fields. And it's at that battle that she plays her role. And her role is this kind of Macbeth-like twist. Now, when I first read this, when I was, I think, 10, I was terribly impressed by this. I thought this was the cleverest thing in the world. It is nicked from Shakespeare, but, you know, if you're going to steal from the best. Come not between the Nazgul and his prey. A sword rang out. Do what you will, but I will hinder it if I may. No living man may hinder me, but she is no man. Her strength is in what she is not. She is not a man. But her strength is also in what she is. She is steely. maiden of the Rohirrim, child of kings, slender but as a steel blade, fair but terrible. She kills the Nazgul's winged steed, and the black rider self-smashes her shield. It breaks her arm with a mace. It's Merry that stabs the Nazgul behind his knee, giving Eowyn the time with her last strength to drive her sword between crown and mantle. This breaks the sword. The sword broke, sparkling into many shards, and it seems to break Eowyn too. So closely has she been connected with her weapon. She's physically like it. She's metaphorically like it. This is all her femininity is. It is a weapon. Now, of course, any soldier is, in effect, a weapon to be wielded by his or her superiors. But the situation that Eowyn dramatises, the passivity of the situation in a double sense, Gandalf tells Aragorn that he has, quote, horses and deeds of arms in the free fields, where she is born in the body of a maid, has the spirit and courage at least the match of yours, yet she was doomed to wait upon an old man, and her part seems to her the more ignoble than that of the staff that he leaned on. And this is precisely the passivity of female confinement and restriction that modern feminism has so exhaustively critiqued. All her life seemed to be shrinking and the walls of her bower closing about her. I cannot lie in sloth, idle and caged, she tells Faramir. So at the end of the novel, she recuperates from her terrible blow of having killed the Nazgul. And this recuperation is accompanied, as it were, by a kind of emotional healing. When she gives up her love for Aragorn and switches her affections to Faramir. Now the scene where she describes this, the scene that describes this transition, this emotional transference, it's written with a haste that seems at least unseemly and I think psychologically rather improbable. After many hundreds of pages in which Eowyn's spirited nature and her understated but heartfelt, hopeless love for Aragorn has been developed, her whole personality swivels about in between two paragraphs on page 1,000 of my HarperCollins edition of the novel. First, Faramir informs her that her love for Aragorn was motivated by pride rather than affection. I'm going to pass over that. You desired to have the love of the Lord Aragorn because it was high and puissant, and you wish to have renown and glory and to be lifted far above the mean things that crawl upon the earth. Then the heart of Eowyn changed. There we are. And she understood it. Suddenly her winter passed, and the sun shone on her. I will be the shield maiden no longer, nor vie with the great riders, nor take joy only in songs of slaying. I will be a healer and love all things that grow and are not barren. And again she looked at Faramir. No longer do I desire to be a queen, she says. He offers his own love in a very different way to this kind of rather highfalutin idiom. Do not scorn pity, he says, that is the gift of a gentle heart, Eowyn. I would love you, Eowyn. Do you not love me? That's not a way to pick up girls, I have to say. You don't go out to a girl in the bar and say, do not scorn pity. It is the offering of a gentle heart. You're going to throw a martini in your face and go off with, Craig David. Daniel Craig, I meant to say. Or, maybe Craig David and Daniel Craig, hang around here. Then the heart of Eowyn changed. And at last she understood it. Suddenly her winter passed and the sun shone on her. Now this does present the critic with a problem, I think. The change of heart is described in terms of the changing seasons, presumably to imply that it's a natural organic development, rather than this implausible psychological wrench, which is clearly what it is. Yet psychological plausibility cannot simply be wished away, and this rings very false. It seems to undo all that Eowyn had previously stood for. Rather than chafing at the social restrictions placed upon women, she now abruptly accepts and even glories in them. Instead of demanding a place in the world, she, even at the price of disobeying her lord and adopting a male disguise, she now falls back into the old stereotype that women are naturally healers and nurturers. But there is, I think, more going on here than just unreconstructed sexism. The key is precisely passivity, and that's what I'm now going to talk about for exactly 7 minutes. This passivity, I think, is something very key to what Tolkien is doing as a writer. In a sense, Eowyn here accepts as part of her healing life as a passive mode. So I'm going to connect this with the word passivity's gerund, passion. Passion is a state of passivity, by way of suggesting that it's under this logic that we have to read Tolkien's elaborate fantasy of Catholic sacrifice and atonement. These are Eowyn's words to Merry when he has been declined military service by Théoden. She says, "Where will wants not, a way opens." This apparently is a proverb of Rohan. "So we say," she adds, but it speaks to a larger theme of the Lord of the Rings as a whole. It is by surrendering one's will that one finds one's way. The will is the idiom of pride, and pride, that Luciferian sin, the pride of Melkor, the pride of Sauron, the wizardly pride of Saruman, uncontent with his lot, and the mortal pride of Denethor. Really, these are the roots of all evil, right down to Denethor's son Boromir. It's the nature of pride to want to work its will, regardless of the desires and sufferings of others. And by the same token, it is the antithesis of pride to surrender one's will. Indeed, willpower in this novel is really problematic. It's a state of affairs exemplified in the nature of the ring at the story's core, which not only functions as a kind of moral lens, magnifying characters' destructive willful possessiveness, but also seems to have a will of its own. Now, this is a religious point. Readers often notice that there are no churches or temples or priestly castes in Middle-earth. This is not accidental. This is a deliberate strategy that Tolkien undertakes. Tolkien wrote to a Jesuit friend in 1953 that The Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work, and that is why I have not put in or have cut out practically all references to anything like religion, to cults or practices, to the imaginary world. For the religious element is absorbed into the story and the symbolism. And it's in this context, I think, that we have to read the novel's fascination with will, or willfulness, pride, and with passivity, or with passion. To be too passive would be to surrender the action of free will, which, as far as Tolkien was concerned, was one of God's most important gifts to us. But on the other hand, to be too willful is to arrogate the divine forms that shape the world, to set one's own individual desires against the will of God. For ordinary mortals, this is hard enough. We are called upon freely to choose to do the right thing, but for kings and for generals, it is harder, in part because the pressure to prioritise ends over means is stronger when you're in a position of power. Pressure, there, is a modern word for something that Tolkien would probably be more likely to describe as temptation. And throughout the novel, characters in power are presented with moral dilemmas that tempt them to make the wrong decision. This is what The Ring does. It presents itself to characters and it says to them, "Use me and become powerful, or give me up and remain weak." Some characters, like Boromir or Saruman, fail this test straight off. Gandalf is tested right at the beginning of the novel. "You are wise and powerful," says Frodo. "Will you not take the ring?" "No," says Gandalf. This is my Gandalf voice. "No. With that power, I should have power too great and terrible. And over me the ring would gain a power..." He sounds a bit drunk. I'll just do my regular voice. "Over me the ring would gain a power still greater and more deadly. Yet the way of the ring to my heart is by pity. Pity for weakness and desire, strength to do good. Do not tempt me." And later in the novel, and then we come back to the third woman in Lord of the Rings, Frodo offers the ring to Galadriel, and she declines as well, but in a rather different way. "I do not deny that my heart has greatly desired to ask what you offer. But for many long years I had pondered what I might do should the great ring come into my hands, and now at last it comes. You will give me the ring freely. In place of the Dark Lord, you will set up a queen, and I shall not be dark, but beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night, fair as the sea and the sun and the snow upon the mountain. All shall love me and despair." Slightly jarring capitalization in this passage marks the place where the grandeur runs the risk of becoming grandiosity. But the point here is precisely that Galadriel knows better than to give in to temptation. And this knowledge is, in its way, a rather grand thing. We get a glimpse of her in the novel as tall beyond measurement and beautiful beyond enduring. And then suddenly she laughed again, and lo, she was... Never trust those bits in Lord of the Rings where Tolkien has "lo" with an exclamation mark after it. Bear with me. "And lo, she was shrunken, a slender elf woman. I passed the test," she tells Frodo. "I will diminish and go into the west and remain Galadriel." So I think what's interesting is that in its contrast to the way that Eowyn relinquishes her dreams of power, of more specifically the way Galadriel's choices not starred in terms of giving up masculine social roles and assuming feminine ones, it is rather an existential crisis that has been averted. Galadriel, by resisting temptation, is able to remain Galadriel. This question of how a ruler has to operate in the world is one the novel comes back to over and over again. Making a decision is a hard thing in Tolkien's universe. At this point in the novel, you'll remember, Aragorn has to decide whether to follow Frodo and Sam into Mordor to help protect the ring or to go after the other hobbits who've been captured. And he should make up his mind. We expect leadership from a leader, but he takes a long time. "Let me think," said Aragorn. "And now may I make the right choice and change the evil fate of this unhappy day?" He stood silent for a moment. And he thinks about it, and he says, "Well, follow the orcs." This mode of relinquishing, because this is giving up the chance to ride heroically into the field of battle, to take the ring even by refusing the ring, is, Tolkien is saying, as great an act of heroism as storming into the war brandishing your sword. "Where will wants not, a way opens," says Eowyn. And it's a sentiment that resonates in the largest sense through the whole novel. So what I'm trying to suggest, I think, is that it's in this light that we're invited to read Eowyn's change of heart with respect to Faramir, or that her love for Aragorn has been an act of will, and the change in her from spring to summer could be described perhaps as a motion of grace within her. So I'll touch base quickly on feminism. It's a large body of discourse, and I can do no more than gesture towards it. It seems, I suppose, kind of axiomatic that a feminist is going to, as here Peter Tancred does in Feminist Research, as a sort of overview of the whole field, to say women need to break out of conformity and passivity moulds. We can neither conform nor be passive. And as we discover the extent of our oppression, we refuse to let patriarchy do the thinking, talking and naming for us. It seems to me almost unarguable. There is a body of Christian feminism that has a slightly more sophisticated, I suppose you could say, relationship to questions of passivity. This is from Rosemary Radford Reuther's Introducing Redemption in Christian Feminism from 1998. Some of the early adventures of feminist ethics, she argued, suggested that women's sins are primarily the sins of passivity, of failure to develop an autonomous self, leaving in place the assumption that men sin primarily through pride. But dividing it by gender is too simple. Although women have been directed to accept passivity, acquiescence and auxiliary existence to men as feminine virtues, they also exist within class and race hierarchies, where they can exercise exploitative hauteur towards those under their power. So this brings me to this word passion. And now I'm going to get a little bit more abstruse. I know you expect that of me. I'm going to start quoting Hegel and stuff. So it's late in the lecture, and I don't want you to fall asleep, so I am going to take off my sweater. And I've been waiting a long time for this. If you're very lucky, I should take off my watch next. So passion is a word that's etymologically linked to passivity. We don't tend to think of it that way, of course. We tend to think of it as something positive, as a positive force, a positive good, often. I feel passionately about this. I feel passionately about you. In fact, when you say that, what you're saying is, I'm surrendering my agency and activity of my feelings with respect to you. This is how dominoes fall, with exactly this passivity. Passion is a relational term. The original meaning of the word is now really only recalled in linguistic fossils. We talk about the passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson's famously anti-Semitic film. Passion in that sense, in that religious sense, doesn't mean the passive, the fury or the intense desire of Christ. It means this period of agonizingly passive suffering that Christ endured. There's no power in the universe that can compel God to lie there and be tortured to death. It's something he does of his own free will. This is very central to Christian theology. By giving up the will, you win. When the will wants not, a way opens. Means more than just that it's only when we give up looking for something that we find it, as it might be when we've lost our car keys and have worn out ourselves in a frenzy of searching for them, do something else and suddenly we'll remember where we put them. It means something more pointedly. It means we must actively surrender our individual will and desires in order to gain what we desire and to get our will. It's precisely the paradox of salvation for a Christian writer like Tolkien. Now, I'm not a Catholic, I'm not a Christian, so I don't want to stray into fields that are beyond me. And this is why I'm turning back to Hegel and Hegel's master-slave dialectic. Something that's been very widely interpreted, a very famous idea that Hegel had, that master and slave do not exist in a simple hierarchy of power, that the master needs the slave as much or more as the slave is under the power of the master. Hegel describes this as a struggle between two self-conscious beings who engage in a struggle to the death before one enslaves the other, only to find this does not give him the control over the world that he had sought. And there are people, so Terry Pinkard, for instance, argues that it's not enough to consider Hegel's master-slave as a purely epistemological relationship between objectivity and subjectivity, which is sometimes how philosophers take it, as a kind of abstraction of the way the dialectic works. It must be grasped as a social relationship, says Pinkard, and I think that's right. I think that's what Hegel is talking about. He's talking about actual societies where people actually have power over other people. Let's say men over women, for instance. Each party discovers that he or she cannot identify what is his or her own without reference to the other's point of view, without, that is, reference to the sociality common to both. It seems almost too obvious to point out that The Lord of the Rings is a book very much concerned with questions of mastery and slavery. It's a novel precisely about the proper and improper boundaries of power, about relations between masters and servants. Sauron's evil manifests predominantly in a desire for mastery. The novel construes pairs in a dialectical power relations that work through these antithetical inversions, often violently, or in the larger context of violence and death. Excuse me. Ooh. Frodo and Sam, for instance. Frodo is the master and Sam is the servant. It's modelled on, I think, a British Army officer and it's Batman, something that Tolkien had personal experience of out of the First World War. And both are happy with their respective hierarchical positions, but you can think of the crucial scene where Frodo is becoming more and more like the faux servile Gollum as the ring takes him over. And Sam thinks the master dead, killed by Shelob, and takes the ring from him and becomes the master for that moment. And that the two cannot function except that they function dialectically together as a kind of pairing. And something similar happens throughout the novel, I think. There's Saruman and Gandalf, for instance. Saruman is the senior wizard, but Gandalf is the true master. And that mastery can only come out of a dialectical clash between the two of them. Saruman and Wormtongue, Frodo and Gollum, Aragorn and Boromir, where Boromir has the social status and Aragorn is just a lowly ranger, although actually Aragorn is the true king and Boromir is his subject. And these different hierarchies have to be, again, and I'm using the word advisedly, it gets bandied around a lot, at least in the circles I move in, dialecticism, and they're very dull circles, but it's being intended here in a kind of specific way, in a kind of technical way. These relationships are all strictly dialectical. The same with Aragorn and Denethor. In each case, and to different degrees, consciousness becomes self-consciousness. Partial knowledge is sublated into higher knowledge, more coherent knowledge, wisdom, we could say. Although rarely in Tolkien is wisdom a thing of comfort. Indeed, part of the mode of the eucatastrophic writing that Tolkien practiced, where the happy ending is delayed and delayed and only comes in right at the end, is a delay of the getting of wisdom to the end, as with Sauron moments before the destruction of the ring, when all the magnitude of his own folly was revealed to him in a blinding flash. Now, all of these specific character relations take place in the novel under the higher rubric, formally speaking, of the ring itself. And the way its function, it's just a ring. It serves its master by making the master invisible and giving him certain advantages. The usefulness of being able to make oneself invisible. necessarily turns about to the point where it is the ring that is the master and the wearer who is the son. Oh, I'm fiddling with my wedding ring. I'm very, that's the second time I've mentioned it, it starts to get suspicious. I am very happily married, I have to say. Although it is a puzzling thing that Tolkien takes the wedding ring, the plain gold band, as the type of his ultimate evil. All the other rings of power have gemstones in them. It's just the one ring that is a plain gold band. The ring stands as a sort of emblematization of the principle of this master-servant domination or oppression. And one of the most memorable aspects of it is the way its domination becomes written on the body via a particular mode of Hegelian death struggle, an ageless withering. You can see it on the left. A nightmare death in life existence, the abstract negation of life itself, in this kind of Hegelian sense. Contradiction and resolution can only happen in the novel via a moment of what amounts to self-mutilation, where Frodo becomes Gollum, and the master becomes the servant, or a kind of conceptual short circuit is effected. Frodo and Gollum physically struggle as master and servant in order to discover who will become the servant of this higher master, the ring. And the contradiction is resolved not via Hegelian negotiation and recognition, but by the literal dissolution of Gollum's body and the ring, the loss of Frodo's finger. Okay, so I've been a bit technical, and I'm going to come back now to the novel as such. And what I'm trying to do, I think, is start to think through a way in which this actual palpable hierarchy of power, patriarchy, sexism, which has produced enormous misery for many millions of women, isn't the only context in which the representation of women in these novels can be read. It's to bring to bear the question of gender representation in Tolkien's writing a more radical reading, politically or ideologically speaking, than has often been the case with critics, fixated as they have been on Tolkien's personal traditionalist Catholic and conservative affiliations. Tolkien's female characters, I think, become less marginal under this reading. Instead, they become crucial dramatisations of the way that passivity and passion interrelate. And this suggests a way in which what appear on the surface rather incompatible views, 21st century feminism on the one hand and 20th century Catholic traditionalism on the other, in fact approach similar insights, again, dialectically, on the complexity of hierarchized models of gender relations. So we've got 3/4 of an hour and you've been very patient, which is how I take it when people don't actually throw things. You may be asleep, I haven't got my glasses on. I'm assuming you're still with me. I'm going to spend a couple more minutes embroidering this argument that I'm making to do with Tolkien, to do with fantasy more generally. And then I'll take some questions, if there are any questions. The argument, I suppose, is that Tolkien's art is fundamentally about an aesthetics of renunciation, about a strength that can only be found in weakness. And the creative agencies of Tolkien's world, being divine in his particular imaginarium, was originally marred by a malign male agency, by Melkor. It was originally redeemed in his legendarium by a female, by Nenna. Mightier than Este is Nenna, sister of the Fianturid. She dwells alone. She is acquainted with grief and mourns for every world that Arda has suffered in the marring of Melkor. So great was her sorrow as the music unfolded that her song turned to lamentation long before its end, and the song of mourning was woven into the themes of the world. But she does not weep for herself, and those who hearken to her learn pity and endurance in hope, for she brings strength to the spirit and turns sorrow to wisdom. The windows of her house look outward from the walls of the world. Now, there is a specifically Catholic interpretation of this, which doesn't speak to me, but is clearly relevant. This is from a quotation from Maurice Barry, from his Darby and Joan. It's quoted by Joseph Pearce in his Tolkien Man and Myth. One has to accept sorrow for it to be of any healing power, says Barry. And that is the most difficult thing in the world. A priest once said to me, when you understand what accepted sorrow means, you will understand everything. It is the secret of life. But there is another context, I think, where this idea that where will wants not a way opens, speaks to the whole logic of fantasy as a mode of art. There's this complex repudiation of the masculine values, I put masculine inverted scare quotes, of inverted scare quotes, inverted quotations, scare quotes, but to the max, inverted scare quotes. Masculine values of agency and action in favour of what is at root a religiously informed conception of passionate passivity. The world, for Tolkien, is neither to be rejected nor conquered. Instead, we must master it and surrender ourselves to it. And there's some more scare quotes here. I apologise for those. Tolkien's sub-creation is notionally a feminised world building. It's defined in relation to the notionally masculine divine creation of the actual world. Yet at the same time, existing in a way that unpicks precisely this opposed hierarchy between wheel and fantasy. Fantasy, this whole, the entire mode in which Tolkien worked, is in this sense not only the woman of literature. It's looked down upon by masculine highbrow literary critics. It's belittled by the largely still masculine academy and so on. It is actually the woman of creation more generally, of artistic and imaginative creation. Fantasy, as Tolkien notes in his celebrated Fairy Stories essay, produces a secondary world into which both designer and spectator can enter to the satisfaction of their senses when they are inside, but in its purity, it is artistic in desire and purpose. I don't want to labour the points about purity and desire in Tolkien's work more generally, but it's worth noting that he thought consolation was one of the primary functions of fantasy. Not only necessary because he sees the mortal world as grievous, but also conditioned by a feminised acceptance of grief as the ground of joy. Fantasy in this sense, Tolkien insisted in Fairy Stories, is, I think, not a lower, but a higher form of art. Indeed, the most nearly pure form. I'm biased because I write fantasy, science fiction more generally. I write in this marginalised, excluded mode of literature, but that seems to me to speak to something true, actually, something quite important. And in a way, I think it is a misstep to think that the way to address what has been historically a large-scale kind of masculinism about heroic fighting fantasy, this kind of thing, where the men are big and muscular and strong and the women are eye candy in tiny bikinis who exist just to be draped over the man's muscular shoulders. That is what I look like with my clothes off, I have to say. And I'm not taking any more off, so you'll have to just take my word on that, although I don't have a big sword. Is that a sword? How could he possibly lift that? So one of the ways you can address this, of course, is by writing female characters as... well, the phrase is kick-ass. I don't particularly like it very much. Which is part of the way that modern fantasy works, the grim, dark logic of contemporary fantasy, where everything is super violent, but everyone is super violent. Women are just as violent as men. And women have to seize agency in death and destruction and power and torture and control. This, it seems to me, is exactly to misunderstand the aesthetic logic of Tolkien's work in the first place. Some of these books are good. I mean, Joe Abercrombie's a friend of mine, and I like his writing very much. He brings a certain wit to this kind of grimdark. Some of it is not so good. The Legion of Shadow. Look how big his whatever that is. I assume that's a... I think it's a rake. I think he's about to go and do some gardening. And il faut cultiver notre jardin, after all. This is a properly kind of feminised philosophy of life as it is. I'm going to close before we run out of time with some counterexamples. Fantasies, I think, that grok what's actually at stake in this dialectical relationship between agency and passion, between these masculine qualities and these feminine qualities. And here's one. J.K. Rowling, the Harry Potter novels. I don't know if you've heard of those. If you haven't, read them. They're very, very good. And latterly, actually, Rowling has said in interviews... she's a bit sad. She's sorry now that she decided to make Harry a boy. It was a conscious decision on her part. She was worried that if she made the protagonist a girl, then boys wouldn't read her books. Girls will read the books anyway, she said, but I need a boy protagonist to snare in the boys. And now she's changing her mind, maybe, I think. But it's a book entirely in that Tolkienian logic, because the way you defeat evil is not by getting an enormous kind of rake-like stabby sword, or having a kick-ass heroine who dresses all in black leather and decapitates you with the slightest look. The route to victory is long and hard won. And it's hard won through values of friendship and community, bravery and persistence, and ultimately through a kind of renunciation. When Harry gives himself up and walks out to be killed by Voldemort, and it's only by doing that, it's only when he gives up his will that he's able to achieve his ultimate victory. It's a very ethically sophisticated moral to put into a young adult story. I mean, I have my problems with J.K. Rowling in certain ways, but you can't fault her success. You can't argue with her success, really. But you also can't fault the sure touch she brings to that. And you know, I have run out of time, I think, so I'm going to stop, because we've now got 6 minutes for questions. So if you could speak questions double time. In fact, if you could do two questions at once, and I'll answer them a double time. I don't know if we have any questions, actually, I'm saying that. Perhaps we'll just sit in silence for 6 minutes. And I'll take more clothes off.
I thought that was wonderfully twisted, and I say that because I thought it was really interesting how you used feminist writings from 1998 to use towards a writing that was written decades earlier than that. But other than that, I thought it was also interesting how each of the women that were expressed fulfilled different roles that were all influential in different ways. And I thought that those three different ways were one of them was terrible, one of them had great strength, but then was subject to passivity, and then the other one was tempted but didn't go into that temptation and remained very much a strong woman as a result. So I'm just kind of confused as to whether the desired result of this would then be for the women in the role to have short legs and be in the Shire?
Just short legs. The rest of them could be normally there. You're right, there's a fourth part, isn't there, which Tolkien would happily endorse, which is another role for women is they can be wives and mothers. And that comes in at the edges of the novel. That's when Sam marries Rose at the end and has kids. And Rosie looks after the kids and does all the cooking. And that's not a model of femininity that has that much purchase in the 21st century, is it? I don't know, perhaps I'm naive about that. It's not a woman's role to stay in the home. I mean, you're, in a sense, you're right. It's anachronistic to apply contemporary feminism to a writer who would have found it all very uncongenial to the way he viewed the world. But the point of doing it, I suppose, is these are texts that still resonate. They have cultural force. People still love them. They still read them. We're going to see films made out of them. It's saying something to us. I'm just intrigued as to what it is. So,
I just wanted to pick up, I've enjoyed your Hegelian dismantling
enjoyed?
The narrative.
Actually enjoyed.
Not, I found it interesting. If someone in Oxford says, I found it interesting, that means they thought it was terrible.
Yes.
So I'm not using that phrase, I actually did enjoy it. So in fact, what I wanted to pick you up on was your key phrase, where will once not a way opens.
Mm.
Which I would actually want to offer an alternative reading of.
Okay.
I think it means the opposite of what you're making it mean, or so I've always thought, because you're glossing it as meaning where the will has no desire, a way opens. And I would read it as saying just the opposite, where there is no lack of will, a way opens. Because the context for it is that Eowyn says the line to Merry. Merry wants to go. He's not lacking in desire, and he's not actually renouncing his desire, nor is she. She's heading off in disguise to join the army that she's been specifically told not to join. So actually, I think it's kind of a scary Nietzschean phrase. I don't think it's about the renunciation of desire. I think it's actually about the pursuit of your desire, even against the odds, even against direct commands by your liege lord. So I think far from being the first moment of concession, I think it's actually a key moment, a key epiphany for her, in which she's able to articulate her own desire and act on it.
Well, that in a non-Oxford sense, that is very interesting.
Because
it could well be. I could be completely misreading this. And there's a danger that it becomes all a bit kind of Buddhist, and that what we should be doing is sitting on the ground and contemplating.
Yeah, I mean, I seriously don't think that that's what the phrase, that reading of the phrase just doesn't fit that point in the narrative
at
all.
Well, doesn't it?
You're absolutely right to say that later she whips out completely. And falls into Faramir's arms, and that's a terrible moment. But prior to that, she's had her Aristyle, which is probably what Tolkien would have seen it as.
Yeah.
And warriors, typically, in the kind of epics that Tolkien drew on, only get one Aristyle. They don't get 50.
But you don't. That's the point, though, isn't it? This is her will is not to go and fight as such. It is to be recognised as a warrior. And the old English idiom of being a warrior wasn't that you fought in secret, it was that you fought openly, bravely for your lord, and everyone saw you do it, and you acquired glory, fame, renown for doing that. And that's what she denied.
But all the things which she eventually gets by going along in disguise,
she gets
all that renown. She gets to reveal herself as the person that she is.
But that's
so I can't see that you will. I don't want to take up your whole 6 minutes, but
she only gets, and it is an interesting reading, and I'm struck with that, and I should go away and ponder it. But I don't know. What do you think? I've misread this key phrase.
I saw it the same way. I assumed it was basically where there's a will, there's a way, just phrased differently.
Where there's a will, there's a way. Well, where wants not?
Potentially, it could be both.
Where will is not wanted.
It's not a game.
It's ambivalent, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that shows you how procrastinating my critical perspectives are, because that really never occurred to me. I assumed it means where you don't, where you give up your will. That's where the way is. When will stop wanting?
At least it's interestingly amphibious, I think. I mean, it can be read both ways dramatically, and it does prefigure her ultimate surrender, which, I mean, it doesn't recuperate that change that happens later.
Yeah.
Isn't I'm inclined to agree with you are reading, not because it's grammatically preferable, because it's not. They seem to be perfectly balanced.
Right.
But because the, as it were, Nietzschean reading seems to require a recasting of a very large portion of the novel to as it were, make it work within the frame of the book. But it requires a bit of thinking.
Well, it does. There are Nietzschean characters in the novel, but they're all evil. And the aim is not to seize, to articulate your will's power and to be live like Superman and so on. It is to give all that up. And the hardest part of doing that is if you're called to be a king. Because then you can run away from your duty as a king, ranging, living in the wilderness for decades. But that's not good enough. You have to somehow find a way of being a king without being a kind of tyrant and dominating others.
Yeah, I'm convinced by your overall reading. I'm just not convinced by your reading of that line.
Okay. I should...
Good morning. Add to that, sorry, that. I originally read this as basically where there's a will, there's the way. But yes, the general message you're seeing in there, I can also see, and given that Tolkien was a philologist and was very aware of the history of words, I wonder if he wasn't actually aware also of the ambiguity of want, and phrases it deliberately in that way, using the word want, in order to bring that ambiguity in, and that in fact possibly both sides are meant.
There's an easy way to check, which is that in Tolkien world, in the Norse and the Old English, vantar means what has just been said. It's a lack. But Tolkien, we know, worked on the OED, and he wrote the entry for wampum and walrus. Look up once.
But could do it,
because he would have been around at exactly the time that the entry for once in both those senses, which occur nowadays, meaning the modern one we want, we desire, we need, but also we lack. He was there. I mean, that's what he was doing. Just another one.
Well, I'm going to side with John, sitting on the front row, because it seems to me the other reading is a reading that says the problem with the good guys in Lord of the Rings is that their will isn't strong enough. They just don't want it enough. They're just not feeling the burn. They're not, not pushing through. They're not sacrificing enough. Ross?
Do we have to choose? Tolkien was a Catholic, and there's that whole strain in medieval Catholicism of O Felix Culpa, that because of the fall, there comes the redemption. Because there is will, there is also passivity. Because there is passivity, there is also will. Both are true. It's tenning. Because Bilbo pitied Gollum, Gollum is there to be the thing through which the ring is destroyed. Because Aragorn wanders unknown, he can become king. But becoming king means that Arwen has to choose mortality. Everything has a price. Every downside has an upside. It's that vision of the intrinsic paradoxes involved in his sort of Christianity. I don't think there's a contradiction. I think there's a paradox.
I agree. And I think it's a theological mystery, is the way he would put it, that it is to do with how important free will is to creative beings, that we have to choose, we have to be active and choose to do the right thing. We can't just go through life in a passive mode. But if we're too active and too willful, and our pride takes over, then we'll choose the wrong thing. Then we need to submit at the same time. And that is a strange paradox, that we have to assert ourselves and submit at one and the same time. Oh.
So it's a bit frustrating to have to leave it there, but we are going to have a wine reception and also a signing that Professor Roberts has agreed to. And we hope you'll join us. We're going to cross the quad and we have volunteers to direct you. This is a bit wrong way around. There was a bit of Mary Martha tension, and I went to get water and so denied him the proper introduction he deserved. But I think his humor and his wit have spoken for him. He's a professor at Royal Holloway, and also I implore you to seek out his fiction. We have Blackwell's here with us tonight, but Jack Glass is the best science fiction novel I read last year, a multiple award winner. And so if you want to get at also his fiction, I encourage you to do that. Thank you very much for coming out to the Tolkien Lecture. We hope you'll join us in future years. And I just want briefly to thank also the master of Pembroke, Dame Lynn Brindley, and our bursar, and the MCR committee, particularly Gabe Schenck, who helped to organize the lecture. And thank very much Professor Roberts for coming out to speak with us this evening.